This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Flurries of fun await this winter in Indiana. Feel the rush of the Midwest's only refrigerated toboggan run. Ski down snow-covered slopes and marvel at frozen waterfalls on a winter hike. When it's time to unwind, from outdoor fun to indoor escapes, your perfect winter getaway starts in Indiana. Plan your trip today at inindiana.com/winter.
Welcome back, folks. We're joined by Eric Hessler, the attorney for the Policemen Association of New Orleans. Eric, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, Noel.
Well, Eric, after a fairly long delay, we finally moved forward with the promotional ceremony the other day in the city at downtown, and folks finally were able to be promoted off the list. What is the mood of the department?
Well, I mean, overall, it's a very good thing to have occurred. It's really good that the process was shown to be, although we don't agree with the process necessarily, it was shown to be implemented fairly, without bias by high-ranking officers, without any cheating. So of course, we're glad to see that. We're glad that these officers that did put themselves up for testing and for promotions were able to achieve what they set out to do. So it's certainly a good day for all of those officers. It's a good day for civil service and for the NOPD rank that was cleared of these terrible allegations that had no merit behind them whatsoever.
Eric, you made the comment that y'all don't necessarily agree with the entire process, and all processes has some frailties to same. What are your observations relative to that?
Well, we had always been a little bit concerned with having inside assessors, not necessarily because we believed that there would be any bias or anything else, but because just to avoid the appearance of such, especially in light of the history of the NOPD's promotions, where that's always been oftentimes. We've been able to show that it was, in fact, something of those type incidents that had occurred in the past. So we had always asked for outside assessors, and now I think the department is going to go in that direction, as they did for the second half, to try and redo the second half.
And is that a commitment that Chief Kirkpatrick has made, do you know?
She did. She made that during the interview sessions that we had prior to her accepting the superintendent's position. And it just didn't come through that way, I think, because the system was already in place that had the inside assessors. But
she inherited that, right?
Yes, correct. And that was approved by the DOJ. So that was the system we had. We did challenge it on these very same grounds, and we challenged it in federal court, and it was dismissed. And then, lo and behold, it does in fact end up happening. The way it ended up happening, and the source that it came from was different in the past, it was usually against one or two individuals. But this time, the entire process was attacked, and it was attacked using allegations against high-ranking police officials, which thankfully was investigated and found to have no merit, no basis in fact.
So it seems as though for the first time, Chief Kirkpatrick makes these promotions, actually made some lateral moves as well. And it seems that she is forming the upper echelon of the NOPD to her liking, and this is really kind of the first opportunity that she's had to do so.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And it's going to be a little different than it has been in the past. I think it's going to be a little more structured like other departments around the country. But she's still in the process of doing that.
My gut, you would know better, tells me that she still has the confidence of the rank and file of the department. Your thoughts?
I would agree with that. She, when she came and addressed the promotional candidates and told them that that the mayor had believed that there was some bias in the process and maybe even some cheating that came up, she admitted to the officers and to the promotional candidates that this is where it's coming from and this is the reasons. I don't think we ever would have had that in the past with other chiefs. They would have simply just said, it's not the time for promotions, or we don't need promotions at this time. But this, I think she, my opinion is that she was just being honest, and we appreciate that, and that goes a long way with these officers when you want to gain their loyalty and their trust.
Well, especially when there's political intrusion, right? Which there's no other way to call it. I mean, that's what it was.
Yeah, and that's what I've always said this, I think the police officers are more afraid of being harmed by political interference than they are in a physical encounter on the street with a suspect. Because they can't combat the political stuff, or it's very hard to do so. We try all the time. And in this case, I think we did come out on top.
Yeah, they're not trained to do so, right?
right.
But it's a sad commentary. Hopefully this puts that issue to rest.
I would like to think so. I would love to think so. No process or system is going to be perfect and flawless. But... there's a way to do things, and there's a way to not do things. And oftentimes the promotional system went with the latter and did it in a way that was never quite accepted and never quite inspired confidence among those that were in the promotion system.
I was one that didn't worry too much about morale. It's good that it's high. I get the sense that the morale is pretty solid inside the department today. True or not?
I would say so. Yeah, it's we have a good morale throughout the rank and file, and I'm sure you can remember not too long ago we were not well off at all. We had people leaving in droves. We had leadership problems, and I think we've rounded that corner, and we're on the upswing.
What has been the reaction as it relates to entering the next phase of the consent decree, as was approved by Judge Susie Morgan?
I think there's high confidence of the leadership that they will get it done and get it done properly. I mean, they've been doing this. They've been running the department and under the consent decree mandates for going on almost 12 years now. And it's worked where it needed to work. In some areas where we didn't quite probably need it, it's still implemented. I don't think anybody's going to try and change anything in that regard. And the officers, that pretty much the whole department that we have now, I would say 85% of them have come on and have never done police work under anything but the consent decree.
Obviously, as a result of the successes of the Super Bowl, the Mardi Gras now has a SEER 1 rating as well, the special event assessment rating by the federal authorities. Do you find that there's a, I'm trying to figure it, the right words, I guess a newfound competency level when we think about threat assessments and things of that nature, obviously on the heels of January 1st. You know, until you have a recent incident or otherwise, sometimes I find that we get on cruise controls, you know, and a lot of details slip through the cracks. That's not a criticism. It's just kind of the way things obviously work. My sense is that there's this newfound attention to detail along those lines. Your thoughts?
Yeah, that January 1st terror attack was... it was eye-opening. I don't think anybody that was out there that morning will ever forget that. And it shows what complacency and just hoping that, you know, that everything's worked in the past, you know, keep working. There's always room for improvement. It's terrible that your weaknesses have to be found and exploited. In that manner, before everybody says, you know, that we need to raise our game. But I definitely believe that you'll never be able to stop all of those things. But you can make it harder for them to accomplish it. Somebody to accomplish such a thing. And I think they'll get that. I think that's going to stay with us for a long, long time.
What's the chatter in the aftermath of Super Bowl? Most people are singing the praises of the NOPD, the leadership, the level of cooperation, collaboration with federal, state, and local agencies as well. Most folks, on a scale of 1 to 10, say it was either, you know, a 9 or a 10. What is the chatter amongst the rank and file?
Well, I think they would consider it a 10. They worked long and hard. Knowing that they had to, and you know, they got a very, very brief rest before they're back to the grind with Mardi Gras, but you know, they'll get it done. They always have. The collaboration of other departments and other agencies has always been there, but probably none so much than now. And hopefully that will stick around, and everything around here will become safe, not only for special events, but for the average everyday citizen that lives and works in the city.
Yep. Final thoughts?
I think, like I said, I think that the NOPD is on the right track. The leadership is responsive to the officers, and I'm just really... Officers, I'm glad that they their morale is good. They're happy to come to work, and they're usually pretty. They're pretty young. A lot of them are young, but a really good group of guys and girls that we have. And I think the future, it looks good for the NOPD if they let the leadership do the leading.
That just means you're getting old, Eric. They're not young. You're just getting old.
That's true too, but. But I like my view from here better than I did back in the 80s and 90s.
No doubt. Eric Hessler, attorney for the Policemen's Association in New Orleans, thank you so much for joining us. Truly appreciate your time, your insight. Have a safe Mardi Gras.
Thank you. Y'all too.
We'll be right back, folks. We'll visit with Steve Yates, Senior Research Fellow, Heritage Foundation, and former Deputy National Security Advisor to Vice President Dick Cheney. We'll talk about European leaders gathering for an emergency meeting after President Trump says they're not included on the talks with President Vladimir Putin. We'll be right back.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. Indeed's sponsored jobs help you stand out and hire fast. With sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/listen. Just go to Indeed.com/listen right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/listen. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof like Aloe, Allbirds, or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling and for shoppers buying simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet and the not so secret secret with Shop Pay that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whenever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout experience as business powerhouses like Aloe, Allbirds, and Skims. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
Ah, can't you see it? A sparkling roadside EV quick charge power facility. It's chargers, control panels, and switchgear powering a renewable energy tomorrow that's squeaky clean. We know that unless you have the right supplier, that world might just be a fantasy. But here at Graybar, with years of renewables experience, we live in that world. Get in touch to see for yourself.
We're now ready to depart.
Book your visit at graybar.com. Yep, Graybar does that.
Hey, I'm Ben Stiller.
I'm Adam Scott.
And we make a TV show called Severance. Severance is back for season 2 on Apple TV+.
Before the premiere, Ben and I are going to be binging season 1 and putting out daily recaps. And after that, we're going to keep going as we recap every episode of season 2.
The Severance podcast with Ben Stiller and Adam Scott is presented by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Listen and follow now on Apple Podcasts, the Odyssey app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you know about the true crimes that inspired a Bruce Springsteen album? Or the murders AC/DC was blamed for? How about Taylor Swift's violent stalkers? Or the suspicious deaths of Brittany Murphy and River Phoenix? These stories and more are told in the Disgraceland podcast, hosted by me, Jake Brennan, every Tuesday, where I dive deep into subjects from the dark side of music history and entertainment. So follow and listen to Disgraceland on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, folks. A couple of weeks ago, President Trump had a lengthy conversation with President Putin. And in the aftermath of that, there was a meeting that was held in Riyadh with Secretary of State Marco Rubio and others from the U.S. with individuals from Russia as well, and developing a construct to establish teams to work toward ending the war in Ukraine and a path toward normalizing relations. Obviously, there were some folks that felt they were left out of this process and they should be integral to this process, both this country of Ukraine and our allies in our European nation allies. And here to talk to us about it is Steve Yates, Senior Research Fellow, Heritage Foundation, former Deputy National Security Advisor to former VP Dick Cheney. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. A pleasure to join.
Steve, I guess it's safe to say there are a lot of nervous people right now in light of what's happened thus far.
Certainly. This is obviously a set of circumstances that are affected by what the last 3 years of policy have been. That affects our economy. It affects our defense supply chains. It also just sort of affects what our options are after this war of attrition has been grinding for this long. So how do you get the killing to stop, as President Trump says, hold and win the peace, and then pull together a coalition to rebuild and also continue to boost confidence in the surviving parts of Ukraine? All of these are very important pillars. And so those conversations in Riyadh are very, very necessary for all of those reasons: the ending of the killing, the holding the peace, and getting that reconstruction commitment in there too.
But it would be safe to say this, that this is a delicate balancing act, right? When you, it looks as though the intentions are to sideline Ukrainian officials as well as our allies in Europe?
Well, I wouldn't put it as sidelining the either of them, in all honesty. To a degree, Europe has sidelined itself by not living up to its own commitments, by sort of seeking economic advantage with Russia while also trying to press this security threat to their periphery. And so I hope that what the Vice President and Secretary Rubio and Secretary Hegseth have all been there trying to revitalize and reawaken Europe to taking care of their own neighborhood. We also have General Keith Kellogg, who has spent a lot of time in Ukraine having conversations about what the realities are on the ground now, what's possible under these new circumstances. And so I wouldn't overanalyze each of these steps about who's in the table. There's going to be a lot of conversations. Some are going to be with Ukraine. Some are going to be with Russia. Some are going to be with others. But the objective remains: how do we maximize the security and freedom for the people who have made it through this war? How do you make sure that the fighting stops and stays ended for a time to allow for the resources that Ukraine has been blessed with to fuel growth for their future generation? It's not easy, but we are where we are, courtesy of 3 years of a war that's kind of been adrift.
But our interests don't necessarily all align, right? And is that maybe the reason that European leaders are gathering together to talk face-to-face about where they see this headed?
Well, our capabilities and our interests don't all align completely, but Europe has a lot of wealth. Europe has significant defense capabilities. And the question is, what does Europe really want to look like? I think the offer that they've operated under, where the U.S. pays an inordinate amount of risk and capital up front, and they play somewhat supporting cast, has to be reversed for their own neighborhood. That doesn't mean isolationism or abandonment. I think that over time, you grow out of being somewhat a junior partner to taking lead in your native region. And that allows the United States to be able to deal with very difficult balancing acts in the Middle East, bigger challenges in the Indo-Pacific region, Asia. Those are areas where Europe will be supporting, but not leading. And we need to lead in some of those other areas. So it's rebalancing, and Europe is going to have to adjust. But ultimately, Europe needs to really commit to take care of their neighbors. And America, I think, can and will be there and support when they do. But we've invested $170+ billion in aid to Ukraine. We need to know where that's going and what will come of that. And Europe is going to have to pick up the pace on that, as we have commitments elsewhere.
So is this a forecasting of maybe, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, capitulation of this more of this leadership role and financial leadership that the U.S. has taken in this endeavor?
I would frame it a little differently. I mean, after you've given $170 billion to to the betterment of another people. I don't think that capital vaporizes and goes to zero. That has to count for something to Europeans, yes, to Ukrainians, and otherwise. And it's not to say the United States won't give any further contribution. I'm sure that there's talk about how that might play forward. And after having given $170 billion in aid and other kinds of help beyond that, surely the United States will actively participate in the reconstruction. There might be mutually beneficial areas there. And if we have accepted a lot of risk and invested a lot in the defense, we ought to benefit, too, from the reconstruction. That's what happened with Germany and Japan in post-World War II. It's not an unusual historical situation. So it wouldn't be disengagement. U.S. is still leading in many ways. We just need the others to step forward where they can literally afford to do so. And that I think is fair, that is reliable and sustainable. Hopefully, though, I mean, the X factor is we don't know for sure what Vladimir Putin's commitment will be to stop this fighting. We have to make sure the deterrence remains strong. We have to make sure that other forms of leverage are used. Vice President Vance talked about that as well in his conversations in Europe. And the Europeans just need to let us know what are they committed to do at what level. After all, these NATO commitments are not commitments the U.S. imposed. These are commitments that NATO made to each other in the wake of Russia taking the Crimea 10 years ago almost. And so it's really, is Europe going to live up to its own commitments to its own neighbors?
You have a lot of experience in this field. How important do you think the territorial gains are going to be for Russia to be able to maintain and keep sane?
Well, that is where these great power talks are going to have to test what is movable in what ways. And, you know, so going back to Ukraine's pre-2014 territorial boundaries, I mean, the international community made a commitment to Ukraine in exchange for giving up the world's most dangerous weapons, their nuclear capabilities. They were promised territorial integrity. And back in 2014 and 15, that was not honored. And so where are these territorial lines going to be drawn? If they're in areas that are currently occupied by Russia, will the international community still recognize the Ukrainian boundary but have some kind of peacekeeping effort in those Russian-occupied areas? This all has to be blanks that are filled in. But that begins by having talks. The Biden administration chose not to talk with Russia at all. Fair enough. But you can't really have a sustainable peace if you don't have talks to find out where all sides are coming from and what elements of this we might have a chance to hold.
So in some respect, this is almost partially going to be intelligence, fact gathering, trying to figure out what is in the mind of Vladimir Putin and what's his end game?
What's his end game and what are the realities on the ground? In the Russian occupied areas, we might not have perfect visibility on where things are. And Ukraine is somewhat of a mixed demographic country. It's really tough in these situations if you're trying to read where do the majority of people in one region really want to affiliate versus those in another. This is, you know, the problem when you have wars of the past that draw boundaries and there are demographic and other forces that pull them in other directions. That's why we end up with these kinds of conflicts. And so there's a lot to have to deal with. We're at the beginning of dealing with it, but I support the idea of President Trump placing the first priority and first, let's stop the killing and sustain that and then talk through where are we going forward from here. That I think is very rational and I think it's been necessary.
Yeah, because I like you, I'm not sure how soon, how quick, or how long before we could ever reach a point where somebody declares victory. I've had a really tough time. I don't know much about all that, but I just had a really tough time getting my head around that and what that would look like. Have you had that same difficulty?
Well, yes, and you know, there have been proposed notions, some of which were articulated by Secretary Hegseth in Europe very recently, but those were developed by people that were officials in the first Trump term that were talked about with the then former president, now current president. Those ideas have to meet with the reality of where will the Ukrainians be in their leadership? Where will the Russians be? And where is there a halting point on this? What will the Europeans be ready, willing, and able to step up and do? Are there other outside powers that are a problem? Like China has been fueling Russia's war machine in differing ways. Is that going to be moderated in any way by what we do or others do? So there's still a lot to fill in. But I think the first thing is, as they say, when you're in the problem of holes, stop digging. And that means stop the fighting, stop the killing, and then figure out what you can do to fill that back in and maybe change the realities and options, but hopefully get better over time.
And you mentioned the defense secretary, my last question. I guess part of this forecasting, too, was the request that they spend, 5% of GDP as opposed to, what was it before, 2, if my memory serves me correct?
Right. No, there's a lot of talk about the percent of GDP, and I support the general notion that more is needed. But I also don't consider it wise to be wedded to the number as much as it is what capabilities are we manufacturing, at what cost, and on what timeline. I mean, America has set a bad example of taking way too long to manufacture something at 10 times over cost. And then you can brag about what percentage of GDP you spent, but it wasn't efficient, yeah, and it didn't get to the battle space on time. So I think getting the right things to actually reinvigorate deterrence and reassurance for allies and frontline states at their expense is a beautiful way to proceed. And whatever percentage of GDP that requires is what we should go for. But I would not be wedded to numbers on a balance sheet myself. I want real capabilities in the hands that need it so that America is not the 911 on call everywhere all the time.
Yeah. Have everyone combat ready, right?
Exactly. To the maximum extent possible.
Yep. Thank you so much for joining us. We know you're busy. We truly appreciate your time and your insights. Steve Yates, Senior Research Fellow, Heritage Foundation, and former Deputy National Security Advisor to former VP Dick Cheney. Have a great week.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers talk and text line. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. Their newly released data from Customs and Border Protection, 61,465 illegal aliens were apprehended at the southern border during the entire month of January, a 36% decline from the previous month. And that number includes 29,116 that were apprehended along the border, the lowest since May of 2020, and 32,349 at the ports of entry. During the previous administration, the average number of illegal aliens encountered at the southern border in January was 141,710. The result of the policies that were implemented by the Biden administration, where they were ferrying illegal aliens directly into our communities, where they were and have been allowed to stay indefinitely. And of course, things are changing very, very fast on that front. And in fact, what's been uncovered in the few days that this administration has been in office is that they've been able to put a halt to a number of these programs, one being a fast-track pathway for migrants, and it was funded by the Biden administration back in 2023, and it was called the Safe Mobility Initiative. And what it did is it established locations, buildings across Latin America, and they were known as safe mobility offices, and that allowed asylum seekers to apply to enter the U.S. in another country. They spent about $80 million on this program. It was very popular with migrants, and what they were doing were flying people in. to the country. They would process them outside of the country, fly them in. That way, they didn't get any of that bad look, bad optics as to what was going on at the border. There's more than one way to skin a cat, I guess. And they figured that this was a way to do it, to fast-track migrants into the U.S. What they found was these really weren't asylum seekers. What they were looking for is economic mobility, which doesn't qualify, right? But it didn't matter to the Biden administration. So they opened their first SMO in June of 2023, and they worked with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees and the International Organization for Migration, and they allowed these foreign nationals the opportunity to migrate legally into the U.S. These SMOs were located in 13 different cities in Ecuador, in the countries of Ecuador, Colombia, Guatemala, Costa Rica, and about 18,000 migrants from South and Central America departed for resettlement into the U.S. Interestingly, a lot of your taxpayer dollars were actually being paid to foreign nationals, not U.S. citizens. So we were paying the citizens of other countries, U.S. tax dollars, to run this program on our behalf, to bring folks in a different way, in an expedited fashion, and utilizing a number of NGOs and others, both outside of our territorial boundaries, inside our territorial boundaries, as we implemented this program over those several years. That's been halted. That's been halted, and there's been a lot of talk about a lot of different things that has gone on that we were funding. And again, when I talk about DOGE, I'm not sure what we fear, but as these revelations are made, like, you know, funding a Lebanese gender specialist to launch a U.S.-funded program to provide mental health services to the LGBTQ Venezuelan youths living in Colombia, just as an example. What are we doing that for in Colombia? And you're going to start to see more and more as they're digging in to the bowels of the budget of these organizations as to what this money was being spent for, where and why, what programs were we funding, sending money to non-government organizations called NGOs, and what they were ultimately doing with it. And in fact, a lot of the descriptions of what they could do and spend the money on were pretty broad. And we ended up funding and financing programs like we just talked about. And how that aligns with our foreign policy, how that helps U.S. citizens in any way, shape, or form. I don't know. I can't get my head around it. Maybe someone has an explanation for it, but it's not readily apparent, right? And it seems as though maybe we should be spending these dollars inside the territorial boundaries of the U.S. for some of the issues and challenges that we face each and every day that can make our country even better. We'll be right back. We'll check in with Scoot. He's on location at Logo Express today, and we'll see what he's got coming your way. Stay with us. Scoot's up next. He's live from Logo Express on the Best Bank in Harvey, and he'll talk about SNL's 50th anniversary special Sunday night. Tom Hanks brought back the character Doug, who is a MAGA hat-wearing dude, and some MAGA supporters are not laughing. That plus more with Scoot. Hope you enjoyed today's show. See you tomorrow.